Hey everybody, it's Mike. Welcome or welcome back to the Revision Church Podcast. While you're here, make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and download the Revision app, which is actually the best way to get access to new content and share it with friends. You can get the app by texting Revision app to 77977. Thanks for listening today. My hope is that this message will be helpful for you and would inspire you to take the next step on your faith journey.
Well, good morning, everybody. You guys doing good today? You're looking good. My name's Mike. I'm one of the pastors at Revision. I'm excited to be here celebrating Easter with all of you. So when I was 10 years old, I rode my bike over to my friend Bo's house to play. And when I got there, he was outside riding his bike too. So we decided to go ride bikes in the church parking lot across the street from his house. Like 5 minutes later, his dog came over. His dad was a fireman, so they had a Dalmatian, which is totally cliche. But it's fine if it's nice. Unfortunately, though, as Forrest Gump would say, he was a mean dog. I just didn't know that yet, so I rode my bike over to pet him, and when I reached down, he growled and then lunged at me and bit me right in the posterior. And so, like, panicked and bleeding ever so slightly, I pedaled home as fast as I could with, like, one leg, and I promised I was never going to Bo's house again. Fast forward, like, 8 months. I had forgiven Bo for his vicious dog. We were still buddies, even though I kind of had developed a fear of dogs, which has been neat because it's lingered with me all the way through middle age. I always feel like all dogs want to bite me. Even when people are like, oh, she's so sweet, she never causes any trouble. I'm like, yeah, right, looks like a butt biter to me. I'm looking. I've been there. Don't tell me. Anyways, that's not part of the story. Bo got sick, missed a few days of school. So his mom called my mom and asked if I could pick up his homework and bring it over. So one day after school, grabbed his homework, and my mom pulled up in front of his house in our gleaming blue station wagon, because this was the early 90s. That's what you drove in the early 90s. And I hopped out and went to the door, and I rang the doorbell. Nothing. Rang it again. Nothing. Knocked. Nothing. It was obvious they weren't home. So I left the homework on the porch under a rock, and I turned to go back to the car, and then I heard it. From the corner of the house, there was a growl, and there was that dog looking angry and hungry. And he started coming at me, so I took off like a bolt of lightning. I shot off the porch, across the yard, and I knew I couldn't outrun the dog, but I felt good about my chances of survival for two reasons. Number one, I had a head start. Number two, I had left the door open. So it was almost as if time slowed down in that moment as I envisioned my escape, just slipping into the passenger seat, shutting the door behind me while my mom peeled out and sped home and I was safe from that man-eater. But then something happened. I looked on in horror as my mother, panicked expression on her face, reached across the passenger seat, grabbed the handle, and slammed that door shut. It's hard to explain the range of emotions you feel right then. Confusion, frustration, rage. Like I had to improvise. I hopped up on the hood and then sat on top of the car and like had to wait for the dog to get bored so I could slip in and go home. And during my time atop the station wagon, I thought of some stuff I was going to say to my mom. And after about 10 minutes, the dog got bored and walked away, so I slipped back in and I unleashed. And in response to my humble query about why my mom thought it would be a good idea to shut a door while the dog was trying to murder me, she said, well, Michael, I panicked. I thought I was going to get in the car and eat the baby. And I figured you would do something, and you did. See, it worked out just fine. You guys might be shocked to hear that response did not make me feel just fine. It made me more mad at my mom and at baby Kelsey. Like, oh, she's so precious. We can't let her get eaten by dogs. Whatever. And to be fair, she grew up to be a much better person than me. But we couldn't have known that was going to happen at the time. And that's my point. It's a funny story to look back on. But in the moment, I was pretty upset and bitter. I think a lot of us have stories like that. We look back and laugh, but they didn't feel very funny at the time. The problem is, though, a lot of us have stories that still aren't funny. We got wounds that we're still carrying with us, things that happened to us that made us feel like the world is broken and our lives are so messed up, we'll never recover. Things that left us just longing for something more and something better than this. I think there's a universality to the human experience. There are these deep desires that exist inside every single one of us that are just part of what it is to be alive on this planet. Like the desire not to die. Something in us as human beings is like, I don't want to die. That dog's chasing me. I'm going to run. I'm not going to do that thing. It seems dangerous. I don't want to die. I don't want to just suddenly stop existing. The thought of that is really terrifying to me. We also have this deep need to be loved unconditionally, to be fully known and yet still accepted. And we want to live in peace with bodies and relationships that aren't broken. But it doesn't take more than a cursory glance around us at our sin-stained universe to understand all those desires are not going to happen because that's just not how our world works. We live in a world of death where everyone and everything eventually comes to an end. We live in a world where love is conditional, where it's impossible to be fully and completely known by another person, and even opening yourself up to that at all leaves you vulnerable to being rejected or abandoned or hurt. And that happens even in the healthiest relationships. We live in a world where our bodies betray us and break down, a world full of Dalmatians chasing after us and doors getting slammed in our faces. And something inside us understands that reality and eventually gets to the spot where we're like, it's got to be better than this, doesn't it? And when we reach that place, and every single one of us eventually reaches that place, we're left with only two real options. We either decide that the universe is a fake, that it's a sham, that we're just existing in some sort of cruel, practical joke, or we decide that we must be made for a different world. There are a whole lot of brilliant philosophers who refuse to allow the idea of God to even enter into the equation, who've come to the conclusion that life is just a cruel prank. Plato said it's like we're sitting in a cave and we're staring at a projection on a wall and we think it's real, but we're just looking at shadows that represent real things we will never grab hold of. Nietzsche said truth doesn't exist, which means there is no purpose and there is no meaning to the universe whatsoever. Sartre said the existence of the individual is completely absurd. More recently, Stephen Hawking penned a theory of fatalism that said we have no real emotions and we make no real choices. Everything is just chemicals reacting with one another, causing our neurons to fire. There's nothing you can do about it. There's nothing you can change, and all of your feelings aren't even real. It's just chemicals. There are a whole lot of brilliant people who've come to the conclusion that the world as we perceive it is simply a mirage. But what if it's not? What if they're wrong? What if our hopes and dreams are real? In his book, Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis argued, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in the world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures can satisfy it, that does not prove the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. So if we have these deep yearnings that are common to us as human beings that we simply can't grab a hold of in this universe, maybe that's not proof that the universe is fake. Maybe that's proof that we were made for a world that really is better than this one. But what do we do with that? Because the gap between what we want and what we got is pretty huge, and the problems that exist in that gap are too big for us to solve. So where can hope be found, if hope can be found at all? Well, Easter is God's answer to that question. Easter is God conquering death and healing brokenness, God stepping out of eternity into the human story and giving everything to set us free. The message of Easter is that the world as God created it to be has been unveiled in Jesus Christ. And we're all invited to belong to it. And the question is, will you accept that invitation? Should you accept that invitation? We all know the world's messed up and things aren't the way we want them to be, but is Easter really the hope that we need? Is that the path worth choosing? Because let's be honest, the story itself is fantastical. That God created the universe, and then he stepped into the human story and took on flesh, and he was born in a barn, and then he lived a perfect life, and then he got killed by these people on a cross, and then 3 days later, he raised himself from the dead, and so we can be forgiven and set free. It sounds almost unbelievable. But what I want us to understand this morning as we dig in is that when you take a closer look at the Easter story, Easter is unbelievably believable. Like, I love the gospel accounts in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I love the detail. I love the way that they remember the story and the way they wrote it down years later. I even love the little inconsistencies. Like one of them's like they put a red coat on Jesus. And one of them's like, yeah, it was a purple coat. And I'm like, well, what color was it? Who's wrong? It was maroon, all right? Everybody knows that. These are dudes. And when you ask a man to identify a color, he operates out of the Crayola 8. One of them looked at that, they're like, that is red. Another one said, no, that's purple. Whatever, who cares? We're just writing this stuff down. But the thing I love most about the Gospels is they all reach the exact same conclusion. Jesus died on the cross. Jesus rose from the dead. And Jesus is God. And the way they paint the picture of what happened is absolutely unlike any other story that's ever been told in the history of the world, ever. There are people who look back and they're like, well, this is a fantastic work of fiction, but we gotta understand fiction that included details which don't really advance the plot, they're just details because they're people's vivid memories. That kind of writing simply did not exist in the first century or the second or the third or the 13th. To quote C.S. Lewis again, this I'm not as a philosopher, but as an expert in his field. Because like when he wasn't writing stories, his day job was a professor of English at Oxford and Cambridge. He was the foremost literary critic of the 20th century. And of the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, he wrote this. I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they are like, and I know none of them are like this. Of this text, this gospel text, there are only two possible views. Either it is stories reported by those who saw them, or else some unknown ancient writer, without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative. I mean, it's wild. Because we don't just believe Jesus is alive because the Bible says so. It does say so, but there's more to it than that. We believe it because Matthew believed it. And Mark and Luke and John believed it. We believe it because James believed it. And that's a big one. James was Jesus' brother. I want you to seriously ask yourself this question right now. What would your brother have to do to convince you he's God? Like, what would it take? I've been trying to convince my brother of that since the day he was born, just so he'd do whatever I wanted. 37 years in, most days he's not even convinced I'm good. Like, your brother would probably have to rise from the dead, and there's no evidence whatsoever, zero, that James was a follower of Jesus before the resurrection. Like, he was out. It just wasn't something he believed in and something he was gonna do. And then, like, one day, this is how I imagine it, he was chilling, and then a guy walked up in a hat, and he's like, it kind of smells like up Jesus in here. And James just looked over, he's like, what's up, Jesus? And Jesus ripped off the hat, and he's like, nothing, what's up with you, bro? And James was like, ah! That's not biblical, it's not in there. That's how I think it went down, right? I don't know. What I do know is that James looked at Jesus and said, I'm in. I believe. I'll give my life to this thing. I'll do whatever you need me to do. I'll even write a book of the New Testament. And Jesus said, sweet, we'll call it James. Like, we believe this thing because James believed it, because Paul believed it. Paul was a guy who hated Christians so much, he murdered as many of them as he possibly could until the day he met the resurrected Jesus. We believe this because his followers were willing to give everything, including their lives, not because of something that they heard, but because of what they saw. And they realized, it doesn't matter what this costs us, the world has to know. And that's what makes the Easter story different than any other story that's ever been told. And to understand it more fully, we got to rewind to ancient Judea. Rome had conquered the area. But for a hefty price, they allowed the Jews to kind of have a little bit of governing freedom. But the Jews really resented that. They were frustrated by the oppression and the occupation, and they thought, look, God gave us this land. We're supposed to have our own kingdom here. And so they kept looking for someone to come save them from the Romans. And what happened was a bunch of different messiahs popped up. These guys start an insurrection, they get a bunch of followers, and then they got crunched. Rome put them down. It was the most powerful empire the world had ever known. At this point in time, it was known as the Eternal City, and it seemed for all the world like it would be an eternal empire. And then this dude showed up in the desert wearing weird clothes, eating a wild diet of locusts and honey. He's like a first century precursor to a hipster, right? He's out there and people are looking at him like, hey, John the Baptist, first of all, why are you eating that? Why are you dressed like that? But most importantly, are you the next Messiah guy? He said, no, no, no. But he's coming. He's going to do something big. And onto the pages of history walked Jesus Christ, a nobody carpenter from nowhere in Nazareth. And he became the most influential figure the world has ever known. He started teaching and people started following him. And he would heal them and he would feed them. And his following began to grow. And that became a problem for the powerful people who ran the temple because they realized they were losing the crowds. And it got exponentially worse after this story. This rumor started to float around that he had raised a dude from the dead. And not just like some random guy, a wealthy, well-known, powerful man named Lazarus. And it wasn't just like Jesus showed up and he was sick, maybe he was dead, and then he got better. No, 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 no. The funeral was over. Lazarus had been in the tomb for days, and then Jesus brought him back, and the crowds went nuts, but the authorities didn't. As they felt that their grip on power and society and influence and money loosening, they banded together and decided we got to do something about this. And so these groups called the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the chief priests, who mostly didn't get along and hated each other, met up. And they decided to do something. We read about it in John 11. So if you got a Bible or a Bible handy, you can crack it open to John 11. It's like 80% of the way through. If you hit Luke, keep going. If you hit Acts, go back. If you don't have a Bible with you this morning, you can follow along with the words on the screen. And if you need one or your kids do, we have them for a bunch of different ages back in that Next Steps area. They come with a reading plan. So if you're like, I'd pick up a Bible, but I don't know where to start. You do now. It's in those Bibles. Grab one. We love it when they disappear. They're free. Please take one home today. This is what it says in John 11, verse 48. These leaders get together and they're like, hey, if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and they'll take away our temple and our nation. Like, people believing in Jesus is messing with the way we do religion, and it's messing with the way we do politics. Like, politics and religion, what a mix, right? They go together like Diet Coke and Mentos. Seems like it should be fine or fun, but there's a huge mess every single time. And so what happens here, these guys are like, all right, this Jesus dude, what if people keep believing in him, he keeps doing good stuff, we're going to lose power. We're going to lose position. We're going to lose our access to cash. That's a line too far. We're going to murder him. And that's where the Gospels get really good. They slow down at this moment from like months per chapter to minutes per chapter. Like, do you have a story that you tell at parties like that's just a really good story, your best story? And then when it gets to the good part, you slow down and you tell like all the intricate details. That's what the gospel writers are doing here. And it's fascinating to see the way it's just burned into their memories, because the stuff was written a few decades after it happened. And I don't know, some people hear that and they're like, well, that's proof that it wasn't real. You know, they didn't write it down for a long time. By that point, they had an agenda. Maybe, but if they had an agenda, it should have at least partially been to get people to admire the folks who were leading the Jesus movement. Like, as a leader, it's real hard to maintain followers if you're not followable. And that's why you see a lot of leaders everywhere you look, in business, in politics, in the church, be like, look at me, I'm number one, I'm the best, look at all the stuff I've done. Because they want to convince you to keep listening to them. And so if there was an agenda, at the very least, they should have put Peter up on a pedestal. He was like the lead leader at this one. They should have been like, yeah, some of the other people weren't great, but Peter, keep listening to Peter. He was courageous and he was brave, but that's not what we get at all. Instead, we get an account that's very real, as in real scared, real insecure, and real concerned for themselves, not for Jesus. Jesus was dead. They bailed on that guy. They're like, whew, nah, he's dead. And if we follow him, we're next. We're not doing that. It sounds horrifying. It's just a fascinating moment to think that these guys who had been with Jesus for years completely bailed the second he died. And they wanted to get away so badly. There's one guy, he started running, and one of the temple guards grabbed his cloak. And what we read is that he just wriggled out of that thing and streaked off into the night. You guys might not have known streaking's biblical, but it's in there. It's in there. And Peter, when Jesus got arrested, his first response was to whip out his sword and try and like murder a guy. He cut off the ear because he was bad at swording. But then Jesus, like this, Jesus had to be like, are you kidding me? When did we start a sword ministry? Peter, did anyone else remember me starting a sword ministry? I don't think we started sword ministry. And then Peter ran away, and like a little girl was like, you know Jesus. He's like, I never heard of Jesus in my whole life. And it gets worse. None of them even went to his funeral. Like he got buried in secret, which was fascinating, by the way, because that almost never happened in Roman society. If you got crucified, you didn't get taken down and buried. You died the death of a criminal. They left you up there as a reminder to anyone else who might want to commit crimes of how they dealt with that. So you just stayed until your body rotted and got picked at by birds until there was almost nothing left. Then a slave would climb up on a small ladder and peel off whatever little pieces were left and take it to the city dump. That's how it worked. But these two dudes who were Pharisees, one named Joseph of Arimathea and another one of his buddies who had told nobody that they believed in Jesus, felt really bad. And so they went and they paid the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, for the right to bury Jesus. And they put him in a tomb and none of his followers showed up. Do we have any Lord of the Rings fans in here? All right. This would be, like, this is the worst story ever told in the history of the world. This would be like if Lord of the Rings happened, but Frodo died. And then a couple orcs were like, I secretly liked Frodo all along, but I'm not allowed to tell anyone because he's like he's our enemy. And then two orcs, they like buried him, but Gandalf and Aragorn and Merry and Pippin were like, I'm not going to their funeral, he's dead. Like, no one's making a trilogy of movies about that. It's a terrible story. Like, this is one of the worst stories ever written, especially for the point is to fool people into following these guys who are the leaders of the church. They were faithless, feckless, fearful cowards who bailed. And the craziest part is Jesus' enemies had more confidence in his movement at this moment in time than his followers did. Because the book of Matthew, chapter 27, verses 62 through 66, this is what we read about them. It says, the next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and Pharisees went to Pilate. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise again. So, give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come steal the body and then tell people he's been raised from the dead, and that deception will be worse than the first. Take a guard, Pilate answered. Go make the tomb as secure as you know how. So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and by posting the guard. Okay, so these political and religious leaders are like, oh, crud, what if he's not in that tomb on the third day? What if they steal the body? As though that would have been the only piece of evidence needed, right? The disciples could have stolen the body and been like, he's alive. No one would have ever asked, where is he? They were going to have to weekend at Bernie's him around Jerusalem at that point, right? They'd put glasses on him and like, oh, he's alive. But never mind that. Like, they freaked out about it. And so Pilate's like, whatever, I don't care. Go put some Roman soldiers there. Put a garrison in front of the tomb. Which means a couple things. First, it means no one was going to steal that body. It couldn't have been done. This is the greatest fighting force ever established, and Roman soldiers paid for abandoning their posts with their lives. So if you attacked them, either you were going to die or they were going to die. They certainly weren't going to leave because then they'd have to die anyway. And the disciples were aware of that, and so the second thing it means is they weren't even going to try to steal the body. That was a pointless endeavor. They abandoned Jesus while he was still alive. They're not going to come back to him now that he's dead. It wouldn't have made any sense for that to happen. And can we blame them? I've been thinking a lot about that this week. Like, you look at what they did and it's easy to judge it, but what would I have done? What would you have done? Their lives were on the line. The question that they had answered was like, why die for a dead man whose death disproved everything he asked you to believe while he was alive? Why? They watched him on that cross, bloody, filthy, broken, in agony, without dramatic music playing in the background like in all of our movies. And they knew if we follow, we're next. We're next. And like he didn't even save his own life. There's no way he's saving us. So we are out on this whole movement. We have absolutely nothing to gain and absolutely everything to lose. And I feel like I probably would have done the same thing, because they weren't wrong. Jesus' main message was Jesus. He came to reveal himself to us. He said, I'm the resurrection and the life. Well, now he's dead. He said, the gates of death and hell won't prevail. Now he's dead. His death made every word that had come out of his mouth a lie. And if he couldn't even live to keep his movement alive, why in the world would his followers die to keep his movement alive? He was right then, at this moment in history, nobody, and I mean nobody, was expecting a resurrection. Like, no one was outside that tomb on Easter Sunday just doing a countdown, like 5, 4, 3, 2, Jesus. Like, they just didn't think it would happen. And we're not here because somebody stole a body. We're not here because somebody gave some really good speeches at one point in time. We are here because a bunch of despondent women who had believed and followed Jesus as much as anybody showed up at that tomb on Easter Sunday to rebury him, because guys did it the first time. Like, they probably didn't wrap him right or use the perfumes right. And that's what they're going to do. And they were certain they were going to find a dead body because they watched him die. And what they found instead was an empty tomb. And this is why you should reconsider following Jesus this morning. Whether you used to and at some point you just walked away from it. Whether you've held Christ at an arm's length your whole life and like, I don't know about it. I'm not going to take it seriously. Whether at one point you got hurt inside the church, not by Jesus, but by his people. Whether you've been fighting not to believe, this is why you should reconsider it this morning. This is the message of Easter. Nobody was expecting nobody. Nobody was expecting nobody, but there was nobody. Well, can you just read this with me? Let's all read it together. You ready? Nobody was expecting nobody. Nobody. And then they showed up at the tomb, and that's exactly what they found, and it completely changed the game. And then his followers, like, still in Jerusalem, this is days later, not years later, days later, these followers who had been so afraid for their lives they denied ever meeting him and ran, walked back out into the streets in the seat of power that had conspired to get Jesus killed in the first place, within walking distance of this hill called Golgotha, where they watched him die. And suddenly they weren't afraid anymore. They understood that it would cost them their lives, and it did. But they walked out fearlessly and said, there's nothing we can do with the rest of our lives, however long they may be, but proclaim this message. You killed him. God raised him. We saw him. And this is the salvation we needed all along. We thought we needed a political salvation, but we've needed a spiritual one. We thought we needed to be saved from Rome, but that's small. That's nothing. What we needed to be saved from was sin and death and separation from the God who created us in love for himself. And that's exactly what Jesus accomplished. He stepped out of eternity into the human story, and he gave his life so that we could be forgiven and set free. Our sin earned death, and so he died that we might live. He paid the price, and then he rose again. He unlocked death from the inside, which means eternal life is possible for us. That's the message these guys started preaching days later. Not because of what they heard, but because of what they saw. And here we are 2,000 years later, not just because we believe an idea is true, but because we believe something happened. Something unbelievably believable. And billions of people around the globe are celebrating the same thing, just like billions before us whose lives were dramatically changed by Jesus Christ because something happened. And like, I know a lot of us walked in here this morning feeling beaten and broken. I know I'm not the only one who sometimes struggles with the sense that the reservoirs of hope inside of me are drying up. And I'm not sure how I can face tomorrow. And listen, I don't know what it is specifically for you. I don't know what it is that's stealing your joy, that's crushing your dreams, that's robbing the picture of the future you have. I don't know what it is today that's making you feel like there has got to be something more and better than this. There's got to be. I mean, maybe it's a broken relationship. Maybe it's pain you're suffering. Maybe it's chronic illness. Maybe it's a financial struggle. Maybe it's your work situation. Maybe it's your family situation. Maybe it's just the senseless hatred and violence that seem to be everywhere we look these days. Like, whatever it is, what I do know is that God's message to you is that you can have hope because of Easter. Because he cared enough to step into our story and he refused to abandon us to the brokenness of our world. He came and he died and he's alive and he's at work right now, setting all things right and making all things new, recreating the world that we were meant for. And he's inviting you into that. He's inviting every single one of us in this morning. And if you've never put your faith in that before, you can. If you've never accepted, if you've never allowed him to fill up the hope inside of you, you can do it. It's free. It costs nothing except your entire life. Well, he was in the Nazi concentration camp where he eventually was killed for his faith. The pastor and theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote, "When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die." And that's the invitation, but there's good news. If you will give Jesus your life, he'll give you his life in return. If you'll die to yourself, he will hand you a brand new life full of all the hope and all the meaning and all the beauty he dreamed you up, knit you together, and placed you on this planet to live. All you have to do is believe and surrender. And I want to invite all of us to do that, no matter where you're at on your spiritual journey, no matter where you've been, to just believe so much in the God who loves us and in the power of the cross and the resurrection that our hope is refilled today. My prayer for the last month and the last week, and my prayer this morning is that all of us walk out of here just overflowing with hope because we have a world that needs it. And it's alive and it's real because Jesus is alive and that changes everything. So I'm gonna pray. And I wanna invite all of you to pray with me. And if you've never put your faith in Jesus, if you've never surrendered, I wanna invite you to just repeat these words. And maybe all of us can repeat these words, but just repeat this as a prayer to God, a prayer of belief and surrender. And a prayer of beginning to reclaim the hope that we were made for. Jesus, thank you. Thank you, I believe. Thank you for stepping into the human story for me. Thank you for dying on the cross to pay the penalty for my sins. Thank you for unlocking death so that I could live. I believe and I give you my life. Will you give me a new life in return? Fill me with hope today. Thank you. Amen. Here's what I want to do now. I want to invite you, if you're a follower of Jesus, to stand. And I don't care whether you've been following Jesus for 50 years or 15 seconds. I want to invite you right now to stand and get ready to celebrate. Because the fact that God loved you and loved me enough to refuse to leave us in the broken space where we were, but instead give everything so we could be forgiven and set free, it's worth celebrating. So that's what we're gonna celebrate today. We're gonna celebrate it. We're gonna sing for joy because our hearts can have joy. We have access to it because of what God did for us. And as the band plays, I'm gonna pray one more time. And then when they play, if you're one of the 15 second followers, if you've been following Jesus for less than a minute now, if you gave your life to him for the very first time today, or maybe for the first time in a long time today, you decided to turn your heart back, I want to invite you to do something while the band is playing. I want you to make your way back to that red banner that says yes in the back corner. Because we have some people back there and they want to encourage you and pray with you and hand you some resources with absolutely no strings attached. And I know that's an intimidating thing to ask. And that's why our nicest people are back there. Everyone else, meaner than those people. They're the nicest people here. They're back at the Yes table and they're waiting for you. And here's the deal. I think it could change the course and direction of your life. There are all the reasons and all the excuses to stay in your seat and sing along with everybody else. But I believe if you decided to follow Jesus today, making the decision to walk back there and talk to those people might be something you look back on as one of the most important things you've ever done. So I'd encourage you to do it, and we're going to celebrate. Jesus, thank you. Thank you for loving us. Thank you for saving us. Thank you for being a God worth celebrating and handing us stories worth celebrating to. Amen.